Mark Dernberger on the road again, and this time we're in Mason, Ohio at the Mother Station, and we're visiting with Paul Jellison. We're inside the main transmitter room of the mothership, I think we'll call it, and I just happen to notice a sign here that says Modulate.
Yes, I modulate. It's actually a... It's actually, there's a group in town called, in Cincinnati called the Modulators. And they had a, hey, you want a bumper sticker? And I saw that and I immediately knew where it was going to go. I didn't tell them, but.
There's, we see it, the latest solid state digital transmitter from Harris called the 3DX. We see a DX50 here, which I assume is your primary backup.
Right, right. Absolutely. The 3DX50 was the beta unit. Harris came to... at the time, it was J-Core. We were just in the process of merging with Clear Channel. And they came to us, wanted to know if we wanted to do a beta test with them. And we said, sure. We put that on the air in 2000, went through a few birthing pains, as you always do with a new transmitter, but relatively few. And it has been on the air pretty much ever since. A lot of people walk in and are extremely envious of the fact that we have a solid-state main and a solid-state backup transmitter.
Exactly. Now, behind the solid-state main and the backup is yet another backup, a Continental 317C.
Yes, yes. It's a Continental 317C1. Still operates fine. It was operating fine the day we took it off. The major reason we finally did decide to retire it was parts were getting hard to get in a reasonable time frame. And then, of course, we've got the two older transmitters. This we actually have four operating 50-kilowatt transmitters here.
And any one of them can be put on the line here at push of a button?
Yes, we've got a switcher that will allow us to actually switch and select any one of the four transmitters to any one of our three loads. Our three loads are, of course, the main tower, which is a half wave. We have a backup tower, which is a quarter wave, what they call skirt-fed tower. And then, of course, we have a dummy load for testing.
Right. So have you ever been off the air?
Yes. Yes, matter of fact. The last time I can remember, we were actually off the air. The main had failed. The backup had failed. And myself and my assistant, Ted Kendrick, were headed up here. And just as hard as we could drive, and Al Kenyon, who's now a senior VP with Clear Channel, Al Kenyon was driving the controls downtown, and he got on the two-way radio and says, "Boys, I'm out of transmitters."
I fired my last bullet.
Yeah, we had three at the time, and
wow.
We were off the air for probably 20 or 30 minutes.
Wow, and it was transmitter trouble, not something common like an antenna problem.
Yes, it was. It was a heavy storm, and it was just a matter of getting up here and resetting some breakers, and we were back on the air, you know, within seconds of being in the door,
right.
But it was one of those, oh, darn.
Now, most of us in the business were in front of our computers on December 31st, 1999, as we approached Y2K. You were out here engaging in a labor of love. Tell us about that.
Well, we had to do Y2K duty because of all the issues involved, and we had went through quite a vigorous Y2K checklist.
So you had to be on duty even though it was New Year's Eve.
Right, and I had people downtown covering the digital audio stuff and all that, and being the boss, I thought, well, okay, I live next door, so why not make it easy on myself? You know, I chose to come over here and just watch the place, make sure, I was pretty confident that nothing was going to happen. But basically, what I did, I got over here, I don't know, 9:30, you know, bored, you know, it's New Year's Eve and I'm not out, so okay, what can I get into? I thought, well, you know what, I'm sort of jokingly said I'm going to do this, so I decided to fire up the old Western Electric, which is the original 50 kilowatt transmitter that WLW operated from.
Put in here in 1927?
It was 1928 is the year it was installed. It is a 1927 model. Of course, it's been much modified over the years. It's been modernized with, you know, some tube.
No, don't say that. Just say it's the original.
Well, you know.
It's much more romantic.
Yeah, I know. But anyhow, the transmitter, I decided to see if I could get it up and on the air, and I had to put a new 807 in the exciter. Fiddled around with it a little bit, brought it up, and it came right up, and we operated till after midnight. And they actually announced, you know, made a couple announcements on the air. And I sent out an email to just a few friends. I think Al Kenyon, Bill Setmeyer, and a couple other people. And Bill, I think Bill got a hold of it and posted it to...
everywhere.
To everywhere. And so it became became quite an event, I guess. You know, everybody was like, oh, that's neat. And had people call me the next year, you're going to do that next year? And I'm like, well, no, I have a life. I actually plan on going out.
But, you know, if you think about the romance of it and the symbolism, what you did, you were approaching the new millennium, and here you fire up a transmitter that was built 70 years earlier. And it came right up online. It sounded pretty good.
Yes, it did. It sounded good. And, you know, the thing is I sat there a little bit and I thought about the audio that passed through this transmitter all during those years. You know, you've got literally, World War II, Korean, Vietnam. I mean, this transmitter was in mainline service until the early to mid-70s.
Really?
So this thing saw a lot of man on the moon. I mean, everything. It was pretty impressive. Once I sit back and started thinking about that, I'm like, wow, that's, you know.
Way cool.
It's a Western Electric, and as you can see, it's got
water
the
cooled,
old,
I assume.
Water cooled. It's a very quiet operating transmitter. That is the one thing, and you can probably hear the background noise in here, the just constant rushing of the fans running on the air-cooled transmitters. When this transmitter's on the air, it's eerily quiet. And when you walk in the building, I sense something's wrong because it's quiet. But this transmitter's sort of interesting. It's got the old fan meters on it. They're not your traditional what they call modular meters. They are sort of a fan style meter. They're very interesting to watch operate. They have interesting ballistics.
Now, you mentioned the quietness of that transmitter, and I would say except when a lightning storm approached.
Well, yeah, or if you're working in here at night, and as Al Kenyon and I, Al Kenyon, by the way, was the chief engineer who hired me as his assistant. We would be in here working at night, the main transmitter was down, and we're doing maintenance. And the place was not air-conditioned, so we had the old, at the time, the windows in the place were the old-fashioned tip-out style windows, the old big, you know, it had a wall of glass with a middle section that tipped out to allow airflow. And so you'd be in here working, it'd be hot, you'd have the windows tipped out, fans running, and every now and then you'd hear this pretty good-sized bang, and what it would be typically was a June bug had flown into the ball gaps on the modulator in the back. So, and the transmitter would clunk, clunk, cycle down, come back up. Every now and then it wouldn't come back up, and I'd have to go running around back, and I knew the magic relay to hit, and I'd whack it. I'd whack it, and it'd come back.
Job security.
Yeah, yeah. And, the old transmitter does, you do know how to where to kick it. Yeah.
At WCCO, we had two. We had the first Western Electric and the last.
Oh.
And side by side. And not only would you hear those things explode like that, the rectifier tubes, the contactors, the plate contactor would go kaboom, kaboom.
Yeah.
You know, and you just...
Yeah, you'd hear clicking and clanking. And, of course, when this transmitter runs also, you can hear, it's not a chirping, but you can hear the modulation transformer in the basement talking to you. So you can hear sounds emanating out of the basement. This is a two-story transmitter, too.
Now we have to go look around here. Is this high-level modulation? I didn't realize.
Yes, this is high-level plate. Yes, okay. Yes.
The ones we had were the Dohertys.
Yes, correct, yes.
Well, this guy must be, what, 25 feet long, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say probably 25 feet long, and there actually was an additional cabinet on the end of it because the output stage used to be push-pull. And they actually the output tube is a 100 kilowatt tube that they were able to run single ended with.
Wow.
So,
and this turned out, and we'll talk about that later. This little 50,000 watt just happened to be the driver for the real transmitter during the 30s.
Yes, exactly.
So in addition to this 25 feet of cabinetry here, there's another whole basement full of support gear just for this, I would think. Right.
Now down on the end where the meters change, there's like a, you see the change in the meters. That's actually another transmitter. That's a Crosley. That was a Crosley cathode. That was built on site here by a guy named R.J. Rockwell, who was the chief engineer, and he was really into hi-fi.
I remember an ad in broadcasting, and you might have it. I'm looking for it on the wall out here somewhere. It was an ad that said WLW is the nation's highest fidelity radio station, and they were actually publishing the specs of the proof of performance.
Yeah,
in magazines.
And that transmitter would meet FM proofs.
Right.
You know, in the early to mid 50s.
I'm dating myself. So there's the famous Kath anode transmitter next to the 1927 50 kilowatter.
Yes.
And then the DX50 and the 317 and the 3DX. And the 3DX, as long as we're talking about size, is about 9 feet wide, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, nine feet by maybe, what, 3.5 feet yeah. deep. And it's all self-contained.
All there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's a couple feet shorter, I guess, than its predecessor, the DX50. They keep compressing them down. We jokingly say one of these days it's going to all be just a big VLSI chip, and you put in power and
with
audio.
With a fan on it.
Yeah, yeah, and you get out RF. So
somebody told me that this latest generation has very little heat rise through it.
Yes, that's correct. The efficiency, matter of fact, when we put the DX50 transmitter in the building, we actually had to put in heat because before the heat from the transmitter was enough to keep the building comfortable. With the advent of the new transmitter, we actually were in a crisis stage to where we had pipes freezing and everything
really?
Else. Yeah, yeah. So we had to get heat in here in a hurry the first year we had it.
How big is this room, would you say, Paul?
Oh, I'm going to say it's probably 45 by maybe 45, 50 foot square. That look about right?
I guess, yeah. And all around the periphery, I see machine shops and tools, and I imagine you machined your own parts out here when you...
Yeah, they're actually in the basement. There is we have a lathe and a shaper and a power hacksaw and a welder and a spot welder. And that's just tremendous fun for me because in a previous life, I was a machinist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so...
So that's another reason you live out here.
I have a great play shop, yes, absolutely.
This is fun, folks. I have to tell you, this is the station we all talk about. And I'm walking by this 1927 model transmitter, which is about 9 feet high, I guess, isn't it? And the coils inside this thing, which handled all of the radio frequency signals, are half-inch diameter copper for the most part, aren't they?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, of course, we can walk around behind this transmitter and actually walk.
Well, let's look at the water-cooled part of it, because that's something folks might find a little unusual. Oh, and now he turned a big wheel, which is an interlock, one way to make sure that you can't open the door without shutting off whatever electricity is flowing through this room.
Yes.
It's a room about, this is fun, I love the echo in here.
Yes.
It smells and looks old.
Yes. It looks like Frankenstein's lab. I have a lot of people say it looks like Frankenstein's lab.
It's probably 15 feet square, and it's full of stuff.
Yes, it has capacitors and huge oil-filled transformers, air-filled. It's got resistors and relays, and I mean it's. And then overhead, we were talking about the water cooling. You can see these long Pyrex glass tubes. They are about an inch and a quarter in diameter, and I would say there's probably a couple of hundred feet of them in series with the water that flows up to the tube. And of course, the tube runs at a potential of around 11,000 volts. Obviously, you can't just plumb a copper pipe into something running at 11,000 volts.
Not for long.
So the theory is we run distilled water in our loops, and distilled water has no mineral content, so it doesn't conduct electricity. And the distilled water actually isolates the tube while dissipating the heat in the tube.
And the Pyrex is actually an insulator.
So you
keep the electricity off of the pump. While we're on that subject, you may have noticed on the NRC bulletin board, somebody asked about the rumor that your pond where you circulated the water for heat exchanging might have been used for a swimming pool. And
Actually, you know, I would not be surprised, although there was a heat exchanger inside. The distilled water was actually internal to the building. The external water, and then there was a heat exchanger, and the external water was treated, but not, I mean, it wasn't, obviously, you couldn't control the purity in the outside environment. People getting in it, realistically, it was only about a foot and a half deep when it was in operation. So
a rumor.
It's a rumor, although the pond's still out there, and right now we've got probably 50 or 60 smallmouth bass in there.
We'll have to look at that. Did you bring a fishing pole? I am looking at something that I suspect is connected to a wheel here.
Yes.
Here it is right here. There is a, I wish I could describe this better, but there's a long operating rod that goes to three big copper bars, and by rotating the rod, it slams those three bars up into their respective sockets and puts what voltage?
That's 2,400 volts.
Well, only 2,400.
Well, but if you'll notice also here is a couple of more of shorting switches, and you'll notice that while we opened the disconnect to walk in the room.
That was that wheel you turned.
Yes, it disconnected the 2,400 volt power.
Right.
It also grounded out the high voltage bus bar for the final amplifier and also for the lower voltage screen circuits, the 1,800 volt.
And this was probably, all this interlocking was probably designed and built right here, wasn't it?
Yeah, you can pretty well bet this was all done here. Yeah.
And you still don't touch anything. You don't?
No,
never. Keep your hands in your pocket.
Yeah, that's right.
Very interesting. So in this, all of this supported the 27?
The Western Electric 50 kilowatt. This is the power vault for that room.
Okay.
And
where are the pumps for the
distilled
water?
The pumps are around the corner.
Around the corner. Okay. Now, there are not a lot of transmitter buildings where you see plumbing supplies on the shelf.
That's right. You know,
look at this.
I think that's, I really think that's where, in the broadcasting business, it's sort of the joke, the engineer's the jack of all trades. Well, I think this is why, because an engineer of old had to be a plumber and an electrician and have a pretty vast knowledge of electronics. So,
did you do any coal stoking here at this site?
It's next door.
You have a coal?
Yes, it's still there. I've still got the 1946 boiler license on the wall.
Oh, for heaven's sakes. Now we're moving into a room where there are hundreds of spools of wire, copper wire, of every shape, color, thickness.
Yes, this is the wire room. They actually wound their own transformers here. You'll notice this
they wound their own transformers?
Yeah, they actually wound transformers here, especially modulation. You'll notice this is square wire, and that's round wire.
Yeah.
And the reason is with square wire, on a winding, you can get more copper density with square wire than you can with round, because if you take two circles and you put them together, you got quite a bit of open area. With square wire, you can get a higher density of copper.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'd never thought of that.
More power.
Is that Litz wire?
It's not Litz. It's just a cotton coated. It's just wrapped.
I've never seen anything like that.
But
it is square.
It's
the way it's drawn or extruded.
Yes. And there are several of the square wires around here, but it's pretty incredible.
So this is just the wire room, although I see you got a few light bulbs and fuses here.
Yeah, that we expanded the light bulbs in our room.
All right, now we're in a room with a couple of pumps, or one pump and
one pump and pieces. These were actually two pumps for the main and the backup transmitter. Everything used to be water cooled in the plant. This pump actually flows the water through the system, and right now we've got it off because running a 5-horsepower motor 24/7 gets to be a little expensive.
Especially with three other backup transmitters.
Yeah, we felt it was probably time to maybe not do that anymore.
So this is the distilled water loop.
Yes, okay. And you can see there's these huge radiators. Mm-hmm. Those are probably...
He's looking at a wall of... all I can see is the filters, but there is a radiator inside there that's not unlike a car radiator, only about 12 times as big.
Right, exactly.
Water flows through them, and there must be a huge blower somewhere blowing air through those filters.
Yes, there's a bank of blowers on the backside that blow those through. I might add that tops, there's actually two radiators here. Some years ago, we had our radiator fail on our generator and freeze and burst. And we knew we were coming up within the next year or so of getting a new generator. So it's like, well, rather than spend several $1,000s getting a new radiator in, we just took the old radiator, which was not in use anymore, and plumbed it into the new generator.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
The old generator.
Now that's engineering.
It worked just fine.
All right. I see it looks like a Harkins Hirschfeld exciter there.
Actually, that is an RCA.
Is it?
STL. That was on for Cincinnatiites. The largest, the tallest building in Cincinnati is the Carew Tower. and that's the big, tall Art Deco looking building in downtown Cincinnati. And the Carew Tower was had this STL transmitter on it. And the receiver was up here to receive the STL signal. The unit consumed 1 kilowatt of power, and it put out 1 watt.
And he means by STL studio to transmitter link. So this was the main path for the signal for a long
time. Yeah, it brought it up. Actually, they brought it up to the Voice of America just down the road, and then shipped it up here on wireline.
Oh, I see.
Because evidently the terrain didn't allow.
Oh, so the receiving antenna couldn't see the transmitter.
Yes, yes. So it was down the road about a mile.
You know, we haven't mentioned that, but we are just a mile and a half from the now decommissioned Voice of America plant. That was the big shortwave site.
Correct. And the Crosley engineers, which WLW was started by Powell Crosley, and Crosley then Avco is what it turned into, and the old Crosley Avco engineers actually worked at the they actually maintained the Voice of America site.
Really?
Yes, yes. They were that was done under contract, and then eventually the workers, you know, the federal government picked up their workers, and I'm told that in the 60s you had a choice. You could either stay with Crosley or you could go down there.
Either be a civil servant or have fun. We talked about this earlier. WSAI in its previous incarnation as WCKY was also at this site, wasn't it?
Correct. Yes, it was actually the bottom half of the residence where I live at was actually the transmitter building for that operation. And then on the upper floor was the apartment for the engineer. So there's always been somebody around here.
So it was always self-contained. And that building's right next door to us here. So you could, for any reason, natural or man-made disaster, you could hole up out here and keep this thing running, couldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. We've got generator power here. We can run. We've got about a 40-day supply of fuel. Quite a bit of offline capability here. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't know after 40 days what I'd talk about, but
you're saying you're going to go sit in the fallout shelter. Can't call them that anymore. That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
Glass block windows everywhere here. This is a huge plant. What's this red light for that's hanging down from the ceiling?
That signifies that this transmitter is on the air. When the red light.
Be careful about that door.
Right. That's sort of like an on-air light. That lets you know that don't turn the thing off.
So this red light was on New Year's Eve 2000?
You betcha.
I'll bet that was a thrill for you.
Yeah, it was.
Jeez. Now we're approaching the machine shop, and it's a huge machine shop. You got room in here for half a dozen people to work simultaneously?
They tell me that when they were running a 500-kilowatt transmitter, there were 13 people on duty, so to speak.
On duty at any given time.
Yeah.
Each had a specialty, I suppose. So we're walking through the shop area, and you've got every...
We've got a pretty good-sized project going on, as you can see. We unfortunately lost one of the transformers in our substation. We own our substation. It is a 2-megawatt substation, which is way overkill for the power level we run now, but it was necessary to run the 500-kilowatt transmitter. The actual old transmitter actually pulled about one point, from what I can find from my records, this site pulled about 1.8 million watts when the thing was on the air.
And 100% modulation.
Yes. Right.
And I heard 33,000 volts was the entrance.
Yeah, 33. Actually, they've jacked that up to... It was 33,000 to 2,300. It has since been changed to 34.5, so we get 2,400. But one of those transformers failed, so we are in the process of converting the plant over to 480 volts and actually getting out of the substation business. It seemed a terrible shame to pump oil out of perfectly clean transformers out in the substation and fill them full of oil dry.
Right.
But there's no need for them anymore. So
the cabling that he's dealing with here as he rebuilds this is triple odd at least, isn't it?
That's called 500 MCM. That's 500 million circular mils.
How thick is that cable?
I would say that cable is probably... Between 3/4 of an inch and an inch. The actual, with the jacket on it, it's a good inch, yeah.
So now you've become a pipe bender as well.
Yeah, well, we've got electricians doing this stuff. These guys are really good. We are attempting to reuse some of the old wiring coming in. You can see the old, that's old lead-covered cable.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So we are attempting to reuse that.
Now he's about to open a fire door. Big, wide steel staircase.
Yes.
Oh, my word.
This is the...
Oh, my goodness.
This is the transmitter that I think caused Hitler to call Powell Crossley the Liar of Cincinnati. Because he could hear it over there and didn't like what was being said about him.
I'm speechless, which for me is really something.
It is a rather impressive piece. The place is very clean. It's been well kept, and I want to, every time chance I can get, to thank the Harris Corporation. For two weekends, they had probably 15 or 20 employees out here on a Saturday cleaning this place up. The amount of manpower that we got because this place was just covered with junk, and I vowed to not let that happen again. Right. But it is just incredible the way this place looks. I mean, they armor-alled the front of the cabinet, and I mean, they really did a great job.
Well, the cabinet, ladies and gentlemen, consists of first of all, in a macro sense, it's a huge black box. It looks like it's about 50 feet wide and maybe 20 feet high. Huh?
Yeah, I think 56 feet.
Now, this was an RCA design, a GE build, and a Westinghouse control.
Westinghouse did the controls, and I think they might have done the transformers. You're right. RCA was the prime contractor, and GE was involved as well. So you'll see basically the big, what I call the big three, hands were on this unit.
Is this the same one that RCA decided to build several of, which ended up at the Aspidistra project in Great Britain during the war, do you think? I know they had a bunch. They were going to build some because they thought this country was going to go superpower.
Well, you know, that could be. I don't know. I don't know about that. That's interesting. Yeah. That's the first I've heard of that. But yeah.
This was a beta site, maybe, for a 500,000 watt transmitter.
Gee, sounds like
Here you go again.
Sounds like history all over again, doesn't it?
Now, I'm also told that RCA, in its wisdom, built this thing in a series of blocks, so one could fail.
Yes, this transmitter is modular. They were in series, which current understanding of doing things like that seems highly unusual to put items in series. You normally parallel things. But, yes, they are redundant. You'll see there's an emergency stop switch in front of every door. And you could actually run up to this, punch the button. It would mute the transmitter. You held the button in. And as you released it, it would isolate this section and bring the other two sections back up, and you could maintain.
Oh, so it just went right around it,
You could bypass a section and get in and work on it. To describe this a little bit, there are three RF sections with their own separate door. Of course, you can enter them from the rear as well. They've got big doors. Then you've got two sections that are modulators, and then you've got the final section is the power supply. The idea was that you could take the section offline and work on it as needed and get back up on the air.
Now, each section, it looks like, if these are symmetrical, consisted of three of these panels. The middle panel where that red kill button is he's talking about also has water valves on it, so you can control the water in and out of the tubes.
Right, so you can, if you need to get in and change a tube, you can shut that section off. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you notice the wheels that look like big valve handles up above, that's tuning and loading.
Uh-huh.
And those go through long drive shafts to the rear, and there's big gear drives.
Again, custom built, probably.
Custom built.
We're looking at the tubes, which were, they look like 898s, maybe?
I believe that's what they were. Matter of fact, there's one standing right over here. It's made by Federal. This tube,
is about 5 feet high?
I stand 6'3", yeah. 6'4", and this tube hits me mid-chest. I'd say 5 feet.
The interesting thing about these old tubes, folks, is the filament leads on these things, and the current required just to light the tube was in the thousands of amperes, wasn't it?
Yes, very, very, very high power. Of course, your plate structure is probably the bottom three and a half feet of the tube, and then you have a huge glass, and on the side of the glass is a socket with a connection for your grid, and then, of course, your filament is actually what hooks to the top. It's actually a triode tube.
And the water connections?
What you see next to you is the actual socket for the tube, and the tube actually sets down in this water jacket, and you can see you pumped your water in, up, and around the tube.
So the heat is conducted off the plate of the tube, as you've discussed it, is a conducting metal, it looks like.
Yes.
And you drop that into a mate here, and it conducts the heat right out and through the... Okay.
Correct.
So that's how they did it.
I don't see a tube type. Oh, here we go. Is this it? Yeah, I think 898 is the correct term. I know there were two different types of tubes, and I think the 898 was the final tube. They had a tube before this that was DC, had DC filaments. And they actually had big motor generators in the basement to actually run the tubes. Then later on, they found that that was inefficient, and they actually got a better tube, and they ran the AC tube and did that up until the time to when they shut the transmitter down. They did, by the way, try to get this transmitter licensed up into the 60s at 625 or 650 kilowatts. And I'm told that that was the power level that the transmitter could modulate to 100% with modern tubes. They were actually going to take the glass tubes out and put in external ceramic.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think this room sounded like when this thing was running and it smelled like? Because it had to be ozone going through here.
I'm sure it did. The sound was probably not too bad because you had a lot of hissing, probably a lot of running water.
Right.
I'm sure you had the pump noise filtering up from the basement. I would imagine the sound of the modulation transformer windings talking. You could hear the station talking quite predominantly. Of course, you had fans and blowers and things, you know, moving air.
And you mentioned earlier that at one time there might have been as many as 13 engineers on duty, so there was probably somebody in here all the time looking at meters.
Correct. Matter of fact, Clyde Hanley told me that one of his duties was to go along with welding goggles and actually look at each tube and make sure that all the filaments were lit.
So again, back to these panels. So you had...
The three panels are about the same for each of the RF sections. You can measure temperature, you can measure water flow. You have two flow meters. Mm-hmm. Each flow meter, you have two tubes, so you have two flow meters. And each of those tubes were in parallel. And then to the right in the same cabinet were two more tubes, of which they measure the flow, and they measure the water temperature. Those two tubes were operating with the other two tubes in the cabinet in push-pull. So you had two tubes parallel, but they were operating in push-pull with their complementary
buddies. My word. Think of that power.
Yeah.
And there were three of those cabinets.
Three of those cabinets.
So there were 12 of these tubes online under normal conditions.
Correct.
Correct. I wonder what they cost. You ever...
I don't know.
Just think of the electric bill here.
Oh, the electric bill had to be phenomenal.
The stories abound about how all the lights in Mason would dim when they brought this thing up.
Yeah, I'm told that if one of the rectifiers backfired, that they could see it on the switchboards down at CG&E control. Of course, you got to figure this was also in 1933, and you know the power generation facilities were
less stable.
I mean they were less stable and not as much of it by any means.
Right. Can we go around the rear?
Sure, absolutely.
We're coming around the back, and now we're looking at...
That is a Faraday shield.
Yeah.
Probably the largest Faraday shield, Faraday screen, that you will ever see. Faraday screen eliminates harmonics, is what it's designed to do. You'll notice you have pancake coils on the you have two sets of coils. They're not like a traditional coil wound around a diameter. This coil is flat, and it starts in the middle and winds out towards its outer diameter.
Three-quarter inch copper
tubing, not unlike what you'd, you know, it's almost like a spiral, one of those spiral psychedelic things you used to see on Get Smart or something. But that sort of describes what the coil does. The way they tuned it, that was your tuning. That resonated the circuit. And to do that...
Paul is turning a cogwheel now.
Yeah, there was a crank on the front, and you turned that crank on the front, which turned a gear down here, and actually moved a half-turn loop closer or further away from the pancake coil.
To add inductance to it.
Okay, so you've got your pancake coil. Then you had the Faraday shield, which eliminated harmonic energy. And then on the other side of the Faraday shield, you have another pancake coil that went down to your output network, to your antenna. This unit, as you can see, it is tipped on an angle, and you could actually, by turning the control, by changing the coupling, you actually moved the coil closer or further away.
So you're saying the whole 500,000 watts went through the air here for a distance of 8 inches?
Yes.
Oh, my word.
It was capacitively coupled. Of course, you got to remember, this was one-third of 500,000 watts.
So. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right.
So, so we're only talking, you know.
175 or
right,
something.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. Then you'll notice that everything here is got any metal that terminates doesn't have a sharp point. It's got this large ring on it. It's a corona ring, they're called. And basically, any sharp point you get with high voltage on it will just arc into the atmosphere under a condition called corona. These are done to eliminate that. And there are countless stories that abound, but you can see where people have
touched it with something
to pull an arc.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. There's some spots on that copper.
Yes.
So there's three of these, and then there must be a combiner somewhere to bring
the... Yeah, there's a combiner network down in the basement that switched and allowed everything to come together.
Or to operate individually?
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
Right. Yes.
Boy, the redundancy that was built into this.
Lead line, too.
Now we're getting into the old and the new.
Yes, this is my ham repeater, which it looks like a ham repeater.
What do you tell people is your QTH, the modulator section of a 500 kilowatt? Wow.
And this is our digital link. We have a T1 line that we run audio back and forth between here and our studios in downtown Cincinnati. And one of the things that we were having trouble with was we were getting little glitches in our digital audio, and called the manufacturer, and I told him, I said, well, we're in a pretty high RF field here. He said, would that have anything to do with it? And he said, oh, no. He says this equipment will run fine up into fields of a volt per meter. I said, well, that's wonderful, but the field here is about 7 volts per meter. He's like, long pause at the end of the phone. Oh, that could be a problem.
That could be a problem.
So
you put it in here
so
for
I
shielding.
Thought outside of the box, and I said, well, gee, here's a lead-lined room. I'll just stick this equipment in here, and it's worked flawlessly ever since.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Not too many of us can have lead-lined rooms solve that kind of problem.
Yes, indeed.
Then what remains in here is a lot of power divider, big resistors, and some
Yes, this
contactors.
Is some of the low-level power supplies and stuff that actually step the 20 or the lower voltage 240 and 2400 up.
What was the plate voltage on this guy and the current? Do you
plate
remember?
Voltage was around 12,000 volts. Yeah. Matter of fact, we can walk out front here. I'll show you the power supply.
So during conditions of 100% modulation, there was 24, 25,000 volts jumping around in this thing, I think. Right?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Wow. This is really something, folks. And this operated from May 1st or 2nd of 35 through about 1939?
Yeah. Something like that? Yeah. Yes, that's correct. And actually, it operated during World War II as well. They used it for some... And I'd like to know more about this. I don't know of anybody that does, that at least we'll talk about it. But I'm told that WLW at night, and I had a friend of mine tell me about this, he's since passed away, said that he would listen to WLW at night, and he would hear them come on during the war and say a couple words, like just odd, bizarre words, like pelican.
Right.
And... He'd say that they'd say it two or three times, then they'd read a text, and then they'd say the word again, and then just continue on programming like nothing ever happened.
Knowing that that word was being received by the underground in Europe, more than likely.
More than likely.
Or even in the Pacific,
with the
signalist.
Yes, yes. You can see the voltmeter, typically 12.5 kilovolts was where it ran, and the power supply typically ran 125 amps.
Talk about a welding.
Yes.
Time meter, 89,455 hours.
Yeah, that's quite a time. That's 10 years.
Yeah, with the testing and everything.
Yeah, yep. with the testing.
When it operated at night during the war, was it on as W8XO?
They actually operated it depended on what they were doing and when they were doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they operated sometimes as W8XO and sometimes as WLW, and so I guess it depended on the era that all this was going on.
Sure.
They also operated shortwave transmitters from here. Actually, they operated shortwave transmitters from here before they did down the road at DuVoice. They operated 6030, which was a propagation transmitter. They operated a couple of aerobic here. And
At this site?
At this site, yeah.
How much room was that?
There's 32 acres here.
Really?
So there's a pretty good amount of room here. Yes, this is the back room of the basement. And in that room was the 500 kilowatt modulation transformer. And as you can see, it's probably 11 feet tall, something like that.
It's oval. It's about 7 to 8 feet long and about, 5 feet wide?
Yes, and it weighs approximately 37,000 pounds.
So you're not going to move that just to make room for some?
No, we actually had two of these. We did remove one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when we were cleaning up for PCB issues,
right.
And we actually removed one, and we actually had to lower a forklift into the basement here, and the forklift actually drug the thing over, and we lifted it with a 20-ton crane.
Oh, my word.
And the guy, the crane operator running the cranes, when he got a hold of it, once he got done, he said that was the heaviest 20 tons he had ever lifted.
the most dense.
Yes.
Compact. Now, ahead of us is the generator. Is this the newer version?
Yes. This is a Cato Light. It's a 210 kilowatt generator. It runs basically the entire property. It runs even the house next door is on this generator. It puts out 480 volts, and will actually run this plant plus the FM transmitter that is out in the back.
And it's powered by a good old diesel.
It's got a Volvo six-cylinder diesel. Turbocharged, and I'm thinking the horsepower is in the range of 400, but don't hold me to that.
Now, you know that our listeners would love to hear you crank that thing.
Oh, I can certainly do that.
Let's do it.
All righty, here we go.
Watch it, folks. Started faster than my car.
Yeah, we keep it warm. We keep the block at about 100 degrees all the time.
Now, you exercise this every month or load?
This runs every Sunday at about 7 o'clock in the morning. It comes on and just runs. It doesn't take the load. And then we have our switching here so that if we're running one of our 50-kilowatt transmitters into the dummy load, that we can run it off of there. That way we don't pay tremendous peak charges.
Your demand meter doesn't
company.
Go up.
Correct.
So there it is. It's it would not fit in my living room, this Cato Light. So this room now, which is big.
Yes.
Is 75 feet long at least, and maybe 30 or 40 feet wide, even longer than that.
I would say 70 feet probably, yeah. Well, you can see the pedestals for the pumps. And matter of fact, there's one of the pumps still back in the corner. And you can see the huge pipes in the back that actually brought the water in.
These pipes are going out, look like they're about 8 or 10 inches in diameter. My word.
Yes. And those pumps, you had a main and a back, or actually you had two complete systems. Those pumps pumped water out to the pond, the spray pond. And then there was another set of pumps, which we got rid of. For some reason, we had a lot of interest in them. They were 100% brass. And the scrap people, seemed to get in line to take those. But the brass pumps pump the distilled water inside, and the old iron pumps pump the water outside.
And the water was pumped out to the pond to go through the air to take the heat out of it.
Correct. Yes. It just sprayed out in the air. It was basically a water cooled system that just sprayed water in the air and relied on that action to cool the water.
And again, where the electrical connections are made, a lot of these old electrical switch panels were exposed, and so there's a big metal cage around this for safety purposes.
Yes, when I came here, when I first came here, this was all open. Matter of fact, of course, there was 2,400 volts was the primary voltage here.
And it is, in fact, active, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, there.
So instead of the traditional big black phenolic switch that you labor to slap over to the side, here we have what are known as knife switches, and there's three ganged together on a piece of, I guess, Bakelite with a great big handle insulated, and you would lever that up and down or left and right to make or break the contact.
Yes, absolutely, and you'll notice there are actually, looks like about six or seven switches. And what really gets interesting is you're throwing the switches in the middle. Your hand, and the reason I know this is because I just did this the other day. As you're throwing the switch, your hand comes perilously close to the fuse right above it,
yeah.
Which is also hot. Here is some of the lead.
Oh, my word. He's lifting a lead cable that's about 2.5 inches in diameter and heavier than...
Just this end I'm lifting probably weighs 50 or 75 pounds.
All lead covered.
All lead covered, yeah. Yeah.
Now over here, I think we're in the high voltage realm.
Yes, that's the 2400 volts coming in from the substation.
All right, and it's not unusual to see block and tackle or chain hoist to move things that are heavier than either of us would like to lift.
Yes, we've put that to good use many times. Speaking of fallout shelters, I'll have to show you that.
Paul is taking us into a room with the traditional backup radio equipment,
yes,
with the power turned on. Yes. So you've got the makings of a complete radio station.
Yes, right? We can basically go on the air here. It's just a matter of putting in a patch cord. We've got a microphone. We've got a mixing console. We've got a cart machine, a tape, and a cassette machine, and a reel-to-reel. We've got all the media for the machines underneath.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
If you're ever listening to WLW and you hear ZZ Top come on with Sharp Dressed Man, you'll know that somebody has activated the emergency backup.
There you go. The traditional cots, and there's some...
I've slept on that cot before.
Have you?
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Do you have the 2 months' worth of food supplies in a closet somewhere that some of them didn't.
You mean the Civil Defense Official Survival
there
Biscuits?
There you go. He's got the survival biscuits.
Yes.
Look at the date.
Date packed February, March, or April of 1962.
I don't think you're going to dig into those, are you?
No. Actually, one of these cans I pulled out the other day looked a little swelled.
This is a tin about 14 inches high, maybe 6 by 10. And it's a sealed tin, just like you get your Spam in, and he's got a box of them over there.
It says it weighs 6 pounds, 15 packages, 26 biscuits each.
So you have biscuits, you have, there's a sanitation kit, which we assume is for sanitation.
You have
everything has the Civil Defense logo on it,
yes,
and here's the drinking water.
This is where you put your drinking water. And then, of course, once you get the drinking water in, you need to have a place to get rid of it, so you've got your...
the sanitation kit.
You've got your toilet seat that goes on top of a barrel. Seat.
And that's got lime in the bottom, or it had probably?
It's got, there's toilet paper and all kind of stuff. You've got, you've got your iodine for water purification.
And you know, some of us are probably not old enough to remember that this was considered a real threat back then, and there was a comfort to knowing you could bolt that door.
Mm-hmm.
And keep going, because if the bomb ever hit, and in the 50s particularly,
yes,
that was really scary.
Absolutely. Of course, now with watching smart bombs and all that, I'd be as far away from here as I could get.
Yeah,
thank
exactly.
you very much. Yes,
exactly.
We are now calling ourselves a primary entry point, and we are a PEP station. We're one of 34 stations, and we operate... at the behest of the White House.
Can I ask you now, were you one of the stations that was hit by the test that went awry a couple of years ago?
No, and that test was actually being done for WLS out of Chicago. WLS did not get taken over because Warren Scholes, the chief engineer, was at the site testing. So he knew that he was... going to be receiving a test. So he was there, and it didn't take over that station. It did, however, take over WTAM in Cleveland. I think it might have got WWL. It got used to be QDR. I think it's 540 in Orlando.
And all the stations that are relying on them probably tripped all the way down the chain.
Yes, and actually it got as far south as Lima, Ohio. And I think the only reason it didn't make it down here because the Ohio state of Ohio is set up that something from Cleveland should have came all the way down and got us. Right. But it didn't, and I think the reason it didn't was the guy in Lima, which happened to be working behind the rack, and heard the test go off and thought he had done it, so he unplugged the unit.
Whoa.
And so
his name wasn't Fred Volby, was it?
No, it wasn't Fred. No, it wasn't Fred. So I believe the story is he thought he bumped something, so he unplugged the unit to be safe and went ahead and that broke the chain, or it probably would have gotten down to here. If it had gotten to us, probably would have got to the state of Kentucky and the state of Indiana. And
if you're a late tuner-inner, you may not remember we talked about this with Gary Wilson about the PPAC system and about how a test was requested. And because the operator did not know there was more than one page of stations to take off the test list, pages 2, 3, and 4 or whatever it is actually took this test, and it was on in some stations on the air for 45 minutes there.
Yeah. What happened was the stations, there was a couple of stations that found out the hardware. They didn't have the equipment in place to actually reset the unit, and I think that got remedied rather quickly after that. Yes.
Okay, leaving the fallout shelters now, we can walk up and look out the windows and take a look at the towers. Now, you've got two towers. One looks to be just a standard tower, uniform cross-section, I guess it's called. It looks like it's about a quarter wave. And then, of course, there's the behemoth, which looks to be freshly painted, and that's the famous Blaw-Knox radiator that is diamond-shaped in the middle and tapered at both ends.
Yes, it's a it's 747 feet to be exact, and it is it was actually shortened. It was originally 827 feet, and they found that the tower was a little long for nighttime propagation and was causing some high angle
sky wave
problems. Yes, and so it was shortened down to actually 707 feet, which means that they took the pole off the top and just dropped the pole down inside the tower and lashed it inside the tower, and so that made the tower roughly a half wave. Well, along comes the 70s and that newfangled FM, and they decided that they needed a place to hang their FM antenna on the tower out here. So they put the pole back up, but they shortened it to just 40 feet sticking out of the top of the tower. It is a little longer than it needs to be, but
you know what DXers love to hear, that there's more skywave there than you want. Our friend Watt Hairston, we both know, down at WSM, sure. Had mentioned that when Blaw-Knox put up that tower down there, they came right up the road and built this one back in the early 30s, I think it must have been.
That's correct.
Is this about the same physical size in the middle?
Physical, 40 feet, something like that in the middle. It's about the same size.
And it's square in the middle. It's
square in the middle.
Tapers up and down.
And the one difference is this one has letters on the front of it.
Right.
It has the call sign on the front of it, and which are about 11 feet tall. I've been up there.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
Yeah. So, I can't reach the top of them.
Are they lit at night? I haven't noticed.
They were originally neon. The neon, of course, was tremendously expensive to maintain, and I think was finally taken off in the 70s. The guy that lived here before me is named Jim Hampton. He said it finally just got to the point to where they just said
they were climbing.
So what we did was actually painted the letters in with a white paint, and then have just sodium lights that shine on it. And they actually do a pretty good job of lighting the thing up.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's guyed only at the middle?
Only at the middle.
How big are the guy cables?
Guy cables are just under 2 inches, inch and 11, 15, 16, 13,
size, yeah. I can see the cooling pond from your office window here.
Uh-huh.
And, you said maybe a foot of water in it is about all. And there were some pipes that go out the middle, and there's sprayers on there, I think.
Right. They used to turn up. Now they're turned down. If you'll notice, the nozzles are pointed down.
Yeah.
The reason is they were losing so much water due to wind.
I wonder if there are any goldfish in that pond besides the bass you talked about.
I have put several hundred goldfish in there, and they don't last long.
Do the bass eat them, or are they just
Yes, they love them. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
That pump, or that whole water system out there is not active anymore.
No,
you can't turn it on anniversaries or anything like that. It's still fun to look at. So maybe people did go swimming in there, but they might have been under the influence.
That's probably the case. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Now I look up, and way over our heads, looks like a shack up there in the sky. That's up there a ways.
Yeah, it's about 90 feet in the air.
What is it?
That's a guard shack. That actually was a watchtower. They had a little shack, and it had a spotlight on top, and during World War II, they had armed guards up there.
So they were worried about sabotage, I suppose, during the war, somebody coming in and shooting out the place?
Yeah, there were motion sensors on the fence.
They were real serious
about it, yeah.
Paul Jellison, thank you so much for your time. You took time off on your vacation here at Christmas week 2002.
Well, you know, I don't consider this work.
You don't? I've just been watching you here, and this is a labor of love for you.
Oh, absolutely. I've lived on this location since 1991, and it's always been just you know, quite an adventure to live here, to say the least. It's a lot of fun, you know. It really is.
What a great thing to say, and to meet a guy who really lives his job and loves it, and to be at a place like this, which has such heritage.
Oh, it's incredible.
Mark Dernberger on the road with the DX Audio Service. We'll be back again next month, and until then, good listening, DXers.